Fewer than four foreign leaders attended Russia's Victory Day parade this year. To understand why that number matters, consider what it replaced. More than 20 international visitors attended the same event just 12 months prior. The parade that Vladimir Putin has used for decades as a stage for projecting Russian power and international solidarity. The March of Armor down Red Square, the immortal regiment procession Putin himself has organized for over 15 years, was, this year, a diminished spectacle. Military vehicles were absent. Internet access was suspended across Moscow for the duration of the day. Security nets were erected around the city. And the Immortal Regiment March, one of the parade's most emotionally resonant traditions, was canceled within the city entirely. Those are the details supplied by Andrei Dubransky of the Center of U.S.-Ukrainian Relations, and taken together, they tell a story that goes far beyond ceremony. They tell a story about the arc of a war, the erosion of diplomatic standing, and the question of whether the international architecture that has sustained Russia's position is quietly beginning to fracture. That story, and its connections to drone warfare over Kherson, nuclear deterrence in South Asia, a proposed $17 billion American warship, and a diplomatic impasse with Iran that no one has yet resolved, is what we're tracking today. Let's stay with Moscow for a moment, because the circumstances surrounding this year's parade were more complicated than the optics alone suggest. According to commentary attributed to Dr. Jason Smart, identified as a post-special correspondent and national security advisor, U.S. President Donald Trump personally requested that Ukraine refrain from striking the parade. The arrangement, as described in the cited account, was structured around a prisoner exchange, 1,000 Ukrainian prisoners of war for 1,000 Russian prisoners of war. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky publicly accepted the terms, reportedly stating that the lives of Ukrainian soldiers held greater value than the parade itself, a notably pragmatic formulation from a wartime leader. But after the parade concluded without incident, Vladimir Putin stated publicly that Ukraine had not been prepared to proceed with the exchange. Dr. Smart characterizes that claim as contradicting the prior arrangement. Independent corroboration of the original terms is not available in the source transcripts, and so the dispute remains unresolved in the public record. What is clear is that the post-parade prisoner exchange did not proceed as described, and that the blame for its failure is now contested between the two sides. The parade's reduced scale matters for reasons that extend well beyond symbolism. Dubransky described a broader pattern. Putin's ability to dictate ceasefire terms has diminished, as international support has waned and battlefield pressure has mounted. He cited Ukrainian forces as inflicting approximately 30,000 Russian casualties per month, a figure he attributed to his own assessment rather than a named institutional source, and one that should be understood in that context. But even allowing for uncertainty in battlefield accounting, the directional claim is consistent with what outside analysts have generally described as a war of significant Russian attrition. Dubransky also flagged a specific internal threat that deserves attention. Far-right figures previously loyal to Putin are now, he says, organizing independent militias, a development he described as a central Kremlin concern. He drew a direct parallel to Yevgeny Prigozhin's earlier revolt, suggesting the current militia activity represents a structurally similar risk. Whether that risk matures into something consequential remains to be seen, but the fact that Kremlin energy is being spent managing it is itself a data point. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is separately quoted in the sourced material as stating that the Russia-Ukraine negotiation process has stalled, and that the United States may withdraw from the talks. That statement, if translated into policy, would materially alter the diplomatic architecture of any eventual settlement. It is worth noting that a U.S. withdrawal from mediation would not end the war. It would, however, remove the pressure lever that Washington currently holds over both parties, and potentially accelerate European efforts to fill that vacuum, a dynamic we'll return to shortly. On the human cost within Russia, Dr. Smart's cited commentary recorded confirmed Russian war dead at 352,000. The regional breakdown is striking. In Tuva, the casualty rate stands at 120 per 10,000 men. In Buryatia, 91 per 10,000. In the Altai Republic, 89 per 10,000. In Moscow, 3 per 10,000. These figures are not attributed to a named external organization in the transcript, but the pattern they describe. A war being fought disproportionately by men from Russia's most economically marginal and ethnically distinct regions has been consistently documented by independent demographic researchers over the course of the conflict. From the politics of Moscow's Red Square, we move to the skies over southern Ukraine, where a very different kind of history is being made. The aircraft at the center of this story first flew in 1969. It is an Antonov An-28, a twin-engine turboprop, the kind of utilitarian workhorse that was never designed for combat. And yet, footage reviewed by French television channel TF1 and aired in February 2026 showed this aircraft operating as an active aerial interceptor against Russian drone swarms, with 115 painted silhouettes beneath the cockpit representing confirmed drone kills. By April 2026, Ukrainian pilot and civilian volunteer Timur Fatkulin confirmed via shared video footage that the aircraft had downed 222 Russian drones using onboard armament. The primary weapon is a six-barreled Gatling-type 7.62mm M134 minigun capable of firing between 3,000 and 6,000 rounds per minute. The crew of four, described not as career military but as civilian volunteers, flies nighttime combat sorties guided by an infrared camera system. That detail alone is worth dwelling on. The people bringing down Russian drones over Ukraine are not, in the most formal sense, soldiers. They are volunteers. Building on that, the aircraft carries two types of interceptor drones under its wings. The first is the Skyfall P-1 Sun, a modular, three-dimensionally printed interceptor with a peak cruise speed of approximately 300 kilometers per hour, a maximum speed of roughly 450 kilometers per hour, and a unit cost of approximately $1,000. The manufacturer, Skyfall, reports production capacity of up to 50,000 units per month. The second is the Merops AS-3 Surveyor, produced by a California-based company called Perennial Autonomy, formerly known as Project Eagle. The AS-3 has a range of up to 12.5 miles, a maximum speed of approximately 175 miles per hour, carries a 2-kilogram explosive warhead, and costs approximately $15,000 per unit, according to the U.S. Army, potentially reducible to $3,000 at scale, according to the Military Show, which is the source for these technical specifications. The AS-3 has been in Ukrainian service since 2024. And importantly, some units have been dispatched to NATO allies Poland and Romania under what the Military Show identifies as Operation Eastern Sentry. That detail connects this improvised Ukrainian capability to a broader allied deterrence framework, one that is being assembled not through multi-billion dollar procurement cycles but through distributed, low-cost platform integration. The operational advantages of aerial launch, reduced intercept time, extended loiter capability, the ability to take off from unprepared strips, multi-payload flexibility, are exactly the kind of characteristics that make this platform difficult to counter with conventional air defense doctrine. Russia is adapting. The Military Show reports that in early 2026, Russian forces began equipping drones with man-portable air defense systems and R-60 air-to-air missiles, and fitting newer drone variants with self-protection systems. Russia has reportedly reached production rates of approximately 5,000 Shahed or Garand drones per month, with plans to nearly triple that figure. Again, these production numbers are not attributed to a named institutional body in the transcript and should be treated accordingly, but the directional trend is consistent with open-source military tracking. The human reality of this drone campaign is documented by American war correspondent Darina Gabreski, who has been stationed in Kherson for more than 3 years and is described as the only foreign journalist currently based in the city. Her account is direct. Russian forces have shifted from analog first-person view drones, which Ukrainian electronic warfare systems largely rendered ineffective, to fiber-optic guided drones that are not susceptible to radio frequency jamming. She reported approximately 20 drone attacks per hour hitting Kherson, 385 per day, and 2,700 per week. And she stated clearly, no reliable detection or interdiction technology currently exists for fiber-optic guided drones. A United Nations report dated October 2025, cited by Gabreski, established a chain of command for drone targeting operations and concluded the acts constitute crimes against humanity. Human Rights Watch reporting was also referenced in connection with that finding. Ukraine's Human Rights Commissioner publicly called on April 18th for international monitoring missions to access occupied territories. The response from international monitoring bodies is not reflected in the cited transcript. Peter Cheer of Academy Securities, speaking independently, corroborated the overall trajectory. He characterized drone technology as, in his words, a permanent and evolving feature of modern warfare, one progressing toward AI-coordinated swarms. That assessment brings us to a supply chain problem that Cheer described in terms that are worth quoting directly. Certain components of THAAD missile systems, the terminal high-altitude area defense batteries that represent one of the United States' primary missile defense assets, contain gallium and germanium. Those elements are sourced almost exclusively from China. Cheer, speaking on the Thoughtful Money program, called this dependency, in his words, absolutely insane. He estimated that only approximately 50 THAAD units were produced in a recent year, against a stated desire to produce approximately 1,000. Each unit costs approximately $45 million. The math, even setting aside the supply chain vulnerability, is stark. This is the foundation of what Tier calls the ProSec investment thesis, production for security. The framework encompasses defense hardware, electricity generation, domestic semiconductor manufacturing, rare earth and critical mineral processing, and shipbuilding. The Department of Defense has published a tiered list of rare and critical minerals, nickel as a first-tier example, cobalt as a second-tier example, and Cheer reads that list as a policy signal with durable investment implications. He also noted that J.P. Morgan announced, in November of the prior year, a $1.5 trillion commitment toward infrastructure investment, which he cited as evidence of institutional momentum behind this theme that extends well beyond government procurement. His base case for the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield over the next 3 to 4 months is a range of approximately 4.3 to 4.5%, a relatively stable projection that he presents as the backdrop for sustained infrastructure and defense investment, rather than the elevated rate environment that would complicate long-duration capital commitments. The most visible expression of the naval dimension of this investment thesis is a ship that does not yet exist, but whose procurement has been formally proposed, the Trump-class battleship, designated BBG of X, as part of what the U.S. Navy calls the Golden Fleet Initiative. The figures come from Navy budget request documents cited by the military show. The proposed FY2027 budget includes $1 billion in advance funds and $837 million in research and development funds for the program. Full procurement is budgeted at $17 billion for the first ship, designated USS Defiant. To put that in context, the USS Gerald R. Ford, currently the world's most expensive warship, cost approximately $13.3 billion. The USS Defiant, if built as proposed, would surpass it by nearly $4 billion. Physical specifications, per Navy budget documents, include a 30,000-ton hull, providing more than 3 times the internal volume of a 9,000-ton destroyer, a length of between 853 and 890 feet, a beam of roughly 105 to 115 feet, and speeds above 30 knots. Crew size is projected at 650 to 800 personnel. The weapons suite is equally ambitious. 12 conventional prompt strike hypersonic missiles capable of delivering conventional warheads at intercontinental ranges within approximately 1 hour, 128 MK-41 vertical launch system cells, 25% more than the 96 cells on the current Arleigh Burke flight, 3 destroyer-directed energy weapons in the 300 to 600 kilowatt range, with potential upgrades toward approximately 1 megawatt, to RIM-116 role. The hull also allows for potential integration of nuclear-armed sea-launched cruise missiles. The overall Navy budget request, cited by the military show, totals $65.8 billion and includes procurement of 17 additional battleforce ships and 16 auxiliary ships. The risks are real and should not be minimized. Major shipyards, Bath Iron Works, Ingalls Shipbuilding, and Newport News Shipbuilding are operating with workforce shortages and existing commitments. The Constellation-class frigate is cited as a cautionary precedent. Its design remained unfinished as of April 2025, nearly 5 years after contract award. A program of this ambition, on this timeline, with these industrial constraints, carries meaningful execution risk. But the PROSEC logic driving it is independent of any single program success or failure. The underlying argument that the United States has allowed critical defense production capacity to atrophy and that reversing that atrophy requires sustained capital commitment is one that enjoys unusual cross-party support in the current political environment. We turn now to Iran, where the situation Peter Cheer described as appearing to move toward a diplomatic off-ramp remains, as of the time of his recording for Thoughtful Money, unresolved. T. Cheer noted West Texas Intermediate crude was near or below $90 at the time of his recording, with longer-dated contracts remaining elevated, a market configuration consistent with uncertainty rather than resolution. His geopolitical intelligence group's consensus view was that one additional round of military strikes may be necessary to achieve conditions conducive to regime change in Iran. The benchmarks they identified: physical removal of enriched uranium from Iran, robust inspection access and constraints on Iran's ballistic missile program. Cheer also noted that Iranian-linked data centers had been affected by prior strikes and expressed uncertainty about the investment attractiveness of Gulf state data center development plans, specifically citing Dubai and the UAE as contingent on the security outcome. He described a 5 to 10% probability, explicitly not his base case, of a final escalatory Iranian missile strike against regional neighbors before any ceasefire. Andrei Dubransky of the Center of U.S.-Ukrainian Relations offered a more skeptical read on the diplomatic trajectory. He stated that experts he consulted anticipate 30 to 60 to 90 more days of Iranian resistance. He noted Iran retains significant ballistic missile stocks and launchers, including short-range ballistic missiles posing threats to U.S. positions and allies in the UAE, Qatar, and Bahrain. His assessment: the U.S. objective of degrading Iranian offensive capability has not been achieved. On the diplomatic mechanics, Dubransky stated the U.S. is communicating with Iran through Pakistani intermediaries rather than through direct talks, a contrast he drew explicitly with the JCPOA process, which he described as requiring 20 months of direct negotiation involving nuclear scientists. He characterized the current approach of one-page memoranda as insufficient for a durable agreement. Both Dubransky and Tichir flagged China's growing centrality in this dynamic. Cheer noted that efforts to use Iranian oil supply disruption as leverage against China may be less effective than assumed, because China has been systematically reducing oil dependency through solar, battery, and nuclear energy development. Dubransky cited Trump's planned travel to China and China's involvement in addressing the Iran situation as evidence that Beijing has emerged as the dominant diplomatic actor in this context. The implication that U.S. pressure on Iran and U.S. pressure on China may be working at cross purposes is one that neither source develops at length, but both implicitly surface. Pakistan's role as an intermediary in U.S.-Iran communications, cited by Dubransky, connects to a separate dynamic that former Indian Deputy National Security Advisor Pankaj Saran addressed directly. Speaking on Strat News Global, Saran attributed Pakistan's recent international visibility, including a reported lunch between Pakistan's Field Marshal and President Trump, directly to what he described as Pakistan's offer of services to the United States in the context of U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran. He assessed this visibility as reflecting a transactional dynamic rather than a strategic shift, noting that Qatar, Oman, and Turkey serve as active mediators in various conflicts, without that activity translating into corresponding strategic standing. His view, Pakistan's intermediary role does not constitute a strategic advantage over India. That brings us to what may be the most consequential doctrinal development covered in today's briefing, India's Operation Sindoor and its aftershocks. Pankaj Saran, who served as India's Deputy National Security Advisor and as Indian Ambassador to Russia, and who now leads the think tank NatStrat, spoke at length on Strat News Global about what he described as permanent shifts in India's strategic posture. His framing was explicit and carefully chosen. He called Operation Sindoor a turning point in India's doctrine, and he stated that no nuclear state had been attacked in this manner by another nuclear state in the preceding 70 to 80 years. The formulation he used to describe the result that India had called out the nuclear bluff carries significant weight in deterrence theory. The fundamental premise of nuclear deterrence is that the threat of nuclear response deters conventional aggression. Saran's argument is that Operation Sindoor demonstrated, for the first time in the subcontinent's nuclear era, that India was prepared to conduct a direct military operation against a nuclear-armed adversary and accept the strategic consequences. That demonstration, in his assessment, changes the calculus permanently. Saran stated his personal assessment, framed explicitly as his own view rather than as official Indian government policy, that India would respond to any future terrorist attack of sufficient magnitude traceable to Pakistan with action equivalent to or exceeding Operation Sindoor without seeking international approval. He described India as, in his words, the sole judge of the scale and seriousness of any such attack. And he characterized this not as a secret doctrine, but as one now placed publicly on the record. The transcript does not contain a corresponding official Indian government statement in the period covered. But the significance of a former Deputy National Security Advisor making this statement publicly, on record, in a widely distributed media format, should not be understated. On the Indus Waters Treaty, one of the most durable bilateral frameworks in South Asia, surviving decades of conflict and tension, Saran confirmed the treaty remains in abeyance 1 year after it was suspended, following what he referred to as the Pahalgam massacre. He noted Pakistan had repeatedly used the treaty's dispute resolution mechanisms against Indian infrastructure projects, and that NatStrat had published a booklet in 2023 calling for a review of the treaty. No Pakistani government response is represented in the sourced transcript. Saran also offered a broader strategic assessment worth noting. On India-China relations, he described a process of progressive defreezing, reduced border tensions, resumed civil aviation and visa processes, increased bilateral communication. He assessed China as appearing, in his personal view, to be in a stronger long-term position than the United States amid current trade turbulence, citing deep economic integration between India and China, and China's demonstrated ability to read U.S. policy instability. On India-Russia relations, Saran, who served as Indian ambassador to Moscow, described Russia as an anchor of stability in India's foreign relationships, and said India must maintain that relationship as a hedge against unpredictable shifts in U.S.-Russia dynamics. His overall framing is consistent with a multipolar strategic posture: maintain the Russia relationship, manage the China relationship, keep the U.S. relationship productive without depending on it. Both participants on the Strat News Global program dismissed SARC, the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, as effectively non-functional. Saran's characterization was pointed. He called it an India-Pakistan standoff being witnessed by six other countries. The suggested alternative is BIMSTEC, the Bay of Bengal Initiative for Multisectoral Technical and Economic Cooperation, which both speakers identified as a functioning framework for regional engagement that does not require resolving the India-Pakistan bilateral impasse as a precondition. Returning to European defense, the picture that emerges from multiple sources in today's briefing is one of accelerating divergence from U.S. systems and doctrine, driven partly by strategic calculation and partly by political friction. Peter Cheer attributed the acceleration in part to specific U.S. rhetorical choices, comments about Greenland, pressure on NATO, and the manner in which trade pressure was applied to European partners. He estimated Europe remains 3 to 6 months from a decisive policy shift toward greater defense and energy self-sufficiency, meaning the shift is not yet complete, but is, in his assessment, now effectively inevitable. He cited a French government initiative requiring agencies to transition away from Microsoft software by 2027 as a concrete near-term data point. He identified Ericsson and Nokia as companies positioned to benefit from European technology diversification, applying his Prosek-style investment logic to the European context. Nokia specifically, he noted, stands to benefit from Europe's push toward technology self-sufficiency in a way that mirrors the domestic U.S. defense industrial build-out he describes through the Prosek framework. On European drone defense capacity, Cheer described drone production as an accessible path for countries seeking to build military capacity without replicating large conventional military structures, and he floated the possibility of repurposing automotive manufacturing facilities for this purpose. That observation is worth sitting with for a moment. The industrial infrastructure of European car manufacturing, currently under pressure from the EV transition and trade disruption, could, in theory, be redirected toward drone production at scale. Whether that transition actually occurs depends on procurement decisions that have not yet been made, but the technical possibility is real. Andrei Dobransky framed the European defense transition through what he called a NATO 3.0 lens. Under this emerging model, Europe is expected to be capable of repelling a Russian advance without full U.S. ground force commitment. U.S.-European command would provide command and logistics functions, while European forces constitute the primary ground presence. He noted non-U.S. ships have been patrolling the North Sea and Mediterranean, with U.S. vessels redirected toward Iran and, per his account, South American operations connected to Venezuela. He also referenced a specific incident that carries symbolic weight. Two Russian drones entered Latvian airspace, with Latvia responding via a diplomatic protest note to Russia. Dobransky characterized this as Russian probing of NATO cohesion rather than a demonstration of European weakness. The distinction matters. If Russia is testing the alliance's response rather than demonstrating its own capability, the adequate response is political coordination rather than military escalation. And Latvia's protest note, in that framing, is precisely the right instrument. On the broader economic pressure that could be brought to bear on Russia, one speaker in the source transcripts made a pointed argument. If Western governments applied sufficient pressure on trading partners, specifically naming India, Turkey, and NATO member countries, those partners would cease facilitating Russian energy trade within days, weeks, or months, rendering Russia economically unable to sustain current societal functions. That claim is not attributed to a named institutional source, and should be treated as analytical assertion rather than verified finding. But it reflects a real tension in Western policy, the gap between what economic pressure could theoretically achieve and what political will currently exists to impose. The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest, currently in Russian-controlled territory, was also flagged in the sourced material. The plant is operating on intermittent diesel generator power. A speaker assessed that systemic negligence, rather than deliberate attack, represents the more probable pathway to a nuclear incident, explicitly comparing the risk dynamic to conditions preceding the Chernobyl disaster. That comparison is inherently alarming, and the fact that it is being made by analysts, rather than dismissed, should register in any honest accounting of the war's potential consequences. Before we close, one development that sits at the margins of these larger currents but reflects the gradual reconfiguration of Southern Hemisphere diplomatic relationships. India and Paraguay are marking 65 years of diplomatic relations, and by the account of Paraguay's ambassador to India, identified as Ambassador Fleming in a Strat News Global interview, the relationship has never been stronger. President Santiago Peña's visit to India produced a $200 million biofuel investment agreement involving an unnamed Indian firm. President Peña formally invited Prime Minister Narendra Modi to attend a Mercosur summit scheduled for July, and Prime Minister Modi indicated he would visit, though the transcript does not include independent confirmation of that intention. The ambassador noted that Modi has previously visited neighboring Argentina and Brazil but not Paraguay, suggesting this would be a significant first. Paraguay currently holds the pro tempore presidency of Mercosur, which recently concluded a trade agreement with the European Union that the ambassador described as one of the largest in the world, reached after approximately 20 years of negotiations. Paraguay's membership gives it access to a market of approximately 300 million people. Existing India-Paraguay bilateral trade totals approximately $400 million in both directions, with the ambassador expressing aspiration to reach $2 billion, characterizing current trade levels as underdeveloped relative to potential. The infrastructure context here is worth noting for listeners. Paraguay operates, jointly with Brazil, the Itaipu Hydroelectric Facility, which the ambassador identified as the world's largest hydroelectric plant by productivity. Approximately 80% of Paraguay's trade moves by barge, and the country holds the third largest river barge fleet in the world after China and the United States. An interoceanic road connecting the Atlantic and Pacific coasts is described as set for completion within 2 years, a piece of connectivity infrastructure that would meaningfully alter regional trade patterns. Sectors of interest for Indian investment include agribusiness, biotechnology, IT, pharmaceuticals, logistics, and renewable energy, particularly solar development in the Chaco region, which comprises 60% of Paraguay's land surface, but houses only approximately 5% of its population. Paraguay is a member of both the International Solar Alliance and the Global Biofuel Alliance, both led by India. Space cooperation is also under discussion, with the ambassador referencing a potential Japan-India-Paraguay trilateral format, and citing Japan's existing satellite cooperation with Paraguay as a precedent. The relationship is small in absolute terms, but it is illustrative of a broader pattern. Countries in the global south are actively diversifying diplomatic and economic partnerships, finding new configurations that connect them to multiple major powers simultaneously. Paraguay talks to India. India talks to Russia. Russia is at war. China mediates, the United States recalibrates. The system is reorganizing itself, not catastrophically, but persistently. If there is a single thread connecting today's stories, it is the gap between the world's declared structures and its operational realities. Russia's Victory Day was held as scheduled, but with fewer than 4 foreign visitors and no military vehicles. Iran negotiations continue through Pakistani intermediaries and one-page memoranda rather than 20 months of direct scientific dialogue. The United States proposes a $17 billion battleship, while producing roughly 50 of the missile interceptors it says it needs, using components almost entirely sourced from a strategic rival. India has called out the nuclear bluff, and a former deputy national security advisor has stated publicly that the next time, the response will be the same or greater. Europe is 3 to 6 months from a decisive break from U.S. technology dependency, and the drones being used to down Russian Shaheds are assembled by civilian volunteers in a 50-year-old turboprop flying night sorties over southern Ukraine. The world is not coming apart. It is being renegotiated, and the terms are being set in real time, on battlefields and in budget documents, and in bilateral summits that don't make the front page. Thank you for spending this time with us. That's your geopolitics briefing for today. We'll have the next one ready for you tomorrow. The developments won't wait, and neither will we. That's your CEOR brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.